as an introduction here before we get started in our next lesson in our series, we'll go through a brief review of what we went over. Like I said last week, I know that there are there's always a lot of information when you go through something that's historical. There's a lot of dates, there's a lot of background, there's a lot of different names, terminology that maybe be new. So hopefully reviewing very, very briefly at the beginning of our lessons will just kind of help with those definitions, because we certainly build on our vocabulary as we move along. So the terminology we went over last week, like Abrahamic religions and the definition of Islam and how historical commentators define Christianity and so forth, all of that's going to be important moving forward. And I, as the lecturer slash teacher, I just assume that, you know, you remember that stuff from last time, so I just kind of use those terms with the hope that that you remember them as well. Just kind of as a thought that I had during Pastor's message this morning, and just kind of our responsibility in sharing the gospel, but maybe not always feeling like we have the knowledge to do so. I definitely feel that way when I teach on these subjects sometimes, because there's a lot of very, very intelligent people that, especially with this, with a topic like this that is open to a lot of secular commentators and historians as well. A lot of people that know a lot more than I do. But if if I don't tackle this topic, if I don't put the study in and hopefully give you guys some information that's useful to you, then I'm missing that opportunity. And in our world of social media, you get on Facebook or Twitter, which is X now, or any of the other platforms, there's plenty of people that know nothing about topics that are chiming in over and over. It's not just giving their 2 cents anymore, they're giving a full $10 bill's worth of information that is just entirely incorrect. And that can be extremely frustrating. But what was brought to my mind as a history teacher was a quote from one of Teddy Roosevelt's speeches, probably one of the most famous speeches he gave, that's known as the Man in the Arena speech. So I'm just going to read you the excerpt, and I think it kind of ties into what Pastor was talking about this morning and our efforts here in trying to broach difficult topics. The most often quoted part of the speech is reads as follows: "It is not the critic who counts, not the one who points out how the strong man stumbled or how the doer of deeds might have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred with sweat and dust and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, and spends himself in a worthy cause, who, if he wins, knows the triumph of high achievement, and who, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat." Unfortunately, we just don't have people that write speeches like that anymore. I think Ronald Reagan was probably the last president we had that was, he was known as the great communicator, but just the power of those words and just kind of echoing and applying them, and maybe it's not a very direct application to what Pastor was talking about today, but it did come to mind, because I think a lot of times we do kind of shirk back from controversial subjects and certainly draw back from the opportunity to witness to people simply because we're worried about making a mistake. But as this quote states, it's really not the person that's going to criticize the way that you do it that counts. The Christians that are sitting on the sidelines and not doing anything, the ones that are not willing to debate people that are really involved in heresy and bringing down the name of Jesus, the Christians that aren't able to stand up to those and then bring down the people that try to do it and maybe make mistakes in the process, those aren't the types of people that we want to really associate with. So let's continue with our topic with that. Okay, so we talked about our objectives. We went through some terminology, defined each of these religions, and then discussed the various populations of each of those. went through a brief timeline so that we could kind of get a picture of what we're going to be talking about today, which is when Muhammad actually receives his vision. So what's going on, what's already happened historically. So Jesus, of course, has already been crucified and resurrected. You have the death of the Apostle John after his revelation. First Council of Nicaea, which sort of establishes basic Christian doctrines and begins a discussion about the canon of Scripture. And then the fall of the Roman Empire. Then what we're going to be talking about today is what takes place there in 610. We'll probably get to the point where we talk about the Hijra and the migration from Mecca to Medina by Muhammad and his followers. Roads that we can take in studying Islam can go a couple different directions. We could just focus on the history part of it, and we could just go through all of the things that I introduced last week. But I think the way that I'd like to do it is talk about the visions of Muhammad today, and give you all a background of the Quran and the teachings of Islam, and then we can actually start talking about the doctrinal parts of Islam before we get into the next historical stages of the Islamic Empire and modern history, because I don't know that it would really benefit us to go through all those historical events without actually knowing the foundations of the religion itself. So a lot of this is going to be, once again, very heavy with information. So if at any point you have a question or need to slow down, I know that structuring these lessons is important and making sure that we can get through information. But it's also not necessarily structured like a specific question and answer time. So if there's any point where you need something explained further, hopefully I'm able to do that. But just go ahead and raise your hand at any point, and we can, as long as it's on topic, of course. We don't necessarily want to jump 500 years later. If you want to talk about the Ottoman Empire in the middle of discussing Muhammad's first visions, that's probably not going to be appropriate for us today. But I do understand that this is going to be it's going to be a lot, I think, in a good way, though. So let's talk about the Prophet Muhammad before he received these visions. And this will give us a lot of good background, and it's very important to understand Muhammad himself, because, as I said last week, you don't understand the religion of Islam without understanding Muhammad. In the recitation that Muslims go through, they have to claim that Allah is one God and He is the only God, and also that the Prophet Muhammad is His messenger. So you cannot separate these two. And of course, Muhammad is a fallible person. And if you don't understand him and his motives and the way that the movement grows from its infancy, then really what follows is going to remain a mystery. Muhammad was born in about 570 AD to a reputable, if relatively poor, branch of the ruling Quraysh tribe of Hashemites. And the citation there is this book here. This is A Concise History of the Middle East, which, if you look at it this way, does not seem very concise. But the Middle East has existed since literally the dawn of creation. So there's a lot to go over, and this is extremely concise. But it's very beneficial to me. And when I was looking at the cover of this book and beginning to read it, I realized that I'm like 90% sure this was our textbook for the history of the Middle East at Bob Jones, which was sort of the start of my interest and curiosity in the religion of Islam. We read excerpts from the Quran, and my teacher was very knowledgeable in explaining to us a lot of this background. So some of the information that I'm giving you today comes from her lectures, and then there's some other information that I'll cite as well. But for a majority of this information comes from this book. This is not a, to my knowledge, written by Christians necessarily. These are just historians, which in some ways I prefer, just because it is a little bit more objective, and then it allows me objectively to give that information back to you from the perspective that we're looking at it. So just kind of a lower class family that Muhammad is born into. He becomes an orphan before he turns six. He's raised by his grandfather, and then a very important point that's going to come up later in the lesson today is that he was then raised by his uncle, Abu Talib. Abu Talib is an influential person in the Meccan city and in their culture, and the fact that he is being raised by him affords him a level of protection from some of the other Meccan politics would probably be a good term to use. He marries his boss, Khadija, when he's around 25. And it's kind of an interesting marriage. So he handles the trade aspect of her job. That's how he gets into the trade of being a merchant, the logistical parts of caravans. So if you think about ancient Middle East, camels and the camel caravans, that kind of comes to mind. That's how trade was done. And it was extremely lucrative because this was around the time that Europe was getting a taste for Eastern spices and the different products that come from what they termed the Orient. And so these caravans were very important, but not just for European trade, which is kind of just now becoming a thing, but for the trade of the area because that's the basis of their economics. So he is successful in handling her part of that economic feature of Meccan ways of life. And so based on his success, their relationship grows into marriage. She is 15 years older than him when they marry, which is kind of odd to us. One thing that is a little bit difficult in like navigating all of this information is the cultural chasm that there is between Western civilization and Eastern civilization. However, I'm reminded of the basis of those civilizations. So Western civilization is much more founded upon Christian values, which we would agree are better values than non-Christian values. So while we may hesitate to make purely cultural criticisms, I think it is entirely appropriate for us to cast each culture and each civilization through the lens of Scripture and say this one's good and this one's bad, which sort of flies in the face of multiculturalism, but that's a good thing because there's not a lot of good information that comes out of multiculturalism. Not every culture is equal. They're monogamous for the entirety of their 25-year marriage, which is not going to be the case after her death. So that's an important point. And then he eventually establishes himself as relatively successful. So again, sort of a middle class, lower middle class. He's at least grown into a position that he can hold for the rest of his life. He'll probably, if he continues on this path, he'll become a person of influence in Mecca. He'll be able to make some political decisions, but that is not the path that he chooses. So what about Mecca, this area of Saudi Arabia that Muhammad is from? Mecca is a pilgrimage destination long before Islam even comes into the picture. The Kaaba is the shrine to the Arabs' polytheistic religion. The Kaaba today is still the pilgrim destination for Muslims. It's just that they believe that the Kaaba was corrupted by this polytheistic religion and that it was supposed to be in honor of Allah. And so, even going back all the way into this time period, you have a lot of pilgrims that are coming back and forth, and the city of Mecca is making a lot of money from those pilgrimages. There's Christians and Jews and some monotheistic Arabs that are known as Hanifs, which all sort of influence Muhammad's interpretation of Christianity and Judaism. Which is a very, once again, and it's important to know that now because once we get into the actual pieces of the Quran that I'll quote soon, you have to realize that the Quran references Judaism and Christianity a lot. but it references them and explains different beliefs of those religions incorrectly. Because Muhammad is influenced by just a few of these people that live in Mecca or that are coming in and out of this trade center. And so he just kind of picks up bits and pieces, and so he'll incorrectly think that Christians believe something that they don't. And to this day, that is a feature of Muslims. They continually regurgitate information that their imams may have told them about Christians that is just patently false. Like, they still believe that the Trinity is three separate gods. And to my knowledge, there are not any Christians really that believe that the Trinity is three separate gods, that we are polytheistic. That is not, you know, I can't say that without a shadow of a doubt no Christian believes that, but it's certainly not a common belief in Christianity whatsoever. And this sort of, these bits and pieces of these Abrahamic religions seem to formulate what his revelations are going to be from the first all the way to the last revelations of the Quran. So Muhammad's drawn to this belief system. He doesn't like the polytheistic nature of the religion of Mecca. He believes that it's wearing down the society and that the values are really sort of detestable. And so he's trying to work through this religion that he's been raised in, but then the bad parts of Meccan society that seem to be even more and more negatively affected by polytheism. And it's in the midst of this internal struggle that he claims to receive his first vision. Did you have a question, Paul?
I do, sir. You have identified two basic belief systems up there as Christianity and Judaism. But Christianity, as we know it today, did not exist at that particular time. Would you define that as being a branch of Judaism who actually believed and accepted the Mosaic and Abrahamic promises, as opposed to those who were only Judaistic in their heritage? Or how do you define that as being an influence in his background that caused him to then create his own interpretation and acceptance or rejection of that?
That's a good question, because Christianity and Judaism has, both of those religions have evolved quite a bit since that time. So this is the year 610, and this is after what we would consider at least a dispersion of the Jews. So there are a lot of Jews that are living in the Middle East, and as we're going to see when we talk about the city of Medina, there, which is known as Yathrib at this time, there are tribes of Jews that live and have a lot of influence in Saudi Arabia. So I, as far as Christianity goes, well, let me finish with Judaism. I think these are Jews, this would be after the destruction of the temple and sort of their dispersion into the general area, the Mediterranean area. The Christians, on the other hand, you know, they could be from a variety of places, and so it's really hard to put a finger on which sect they may closely identify with, whether they would be sort of the first population of Catholics, or whether they may be Christians that were a result of different missionary trips that followed the apostles' various trips that they took. So it's difficult to know what exactly those Christians believed, just because it was pretty, we're after the Council of Nicaea, but they're trying to establish the actual doctrines. We may have more in common with these early Christians than we think, or we may have less in common. It's just hard to know what exactly they would have believed. But what we can say is that these are Christians who believe that Jesus was the Messiah, and I don't think that their population would be wholly Messianic Jews. I think it would be Gentiles that would have believed as well. But that's my take on this. I wouldn't necessarily have any sources to back myself up. All right, so let's talk about Muhammad's first vision. He goes into nearby caves to meditate, and again, this is during the sort of internal struggle within himself about the polytheistic religion of Mecca and issues that he sees societally, culturally, politically in that city. And the Quran actually records these visions, and so I'll read to you from Muhammad's version of this himself, but just kind of some surface definitions here. A surah in the Quran is considered a chapter, and an ayah is directly interpreted signs or a miracle, but the way that it's broken down in the Quran, it's actually, it looks more like verses because they're numbered. So if you were to buy a Quran or to access the Quran online, it would look like a book of the Bible in the way that it's broken down. So you have chapters, and it seems like you have verses as well. The thing about the Quran is there are no books of the Quran. The Quran is a Quran. So it's divided into different topics. You know, like in this surah, he talks about this. The other issue about it, as you can see, is I'm about to read Quran 96, 1 through 5, and this is about Muhammad's vision. You go, 96? So you're 96 chapters into the Quran, and you're just now talking about Muhammad's vision? It's not written chronologically. It's written in a way that is, it's more of a narrative. It's written in prose, which makes it entirely difficult to understand. And something that, you know, that's why I'm not asking you guys to read the Quran, because it's not going to help you. It's extremely confusing, and it's so confusing, in fact, that the Muslims divide the teachings of the Quran into things that are clear and things that are unclear. So they're like, well, the Quran definitely says this, but there's these verses that we're actually not really sure what it means. And that's kind of an interesting difference between, you know, how we would read the Bible and how the Muslims read the Quran. So in Quran 96, the 96th surah of the Quran, it reads, this is what he claims that the angel Gabriel is ordering him to do as he hugs him until he's almost suffocating. The angel says, read, in the name of the Lord, in the name of thy Lord who created mankind from a blood clot, read, for thy Lord, the most generous, has taught by the pen, taught man what he knew not. So this is what he's first experiencing this in the cave. He then goes back home and is allegedly just like super shook up about this experience and thinks that he might be going crazy. And basically his wife and some of his other friends, he has another friend who is what was the term? Hanif. He has a friend who is in Hanif, who is which means he's monotheistic. They convince him that, you know, this might be something that you need to pay attention to. And again, this is all allegedly. This is based on different accounts. So it casts Muhammad as sort of this doubtful person who is just a victim of an intense revelation from the angel Gabriel, who was sent by God. You know, what this story actually entails, of course, is kind of lost to history because Muhammad's record of the visions are the only primary source that we have, similar to Joseph Smith's visions. And, you know, that's the only record we have because nobody else was able to witness it, right? So then he goes home. He's shaking almost violently. His wife wraps him in a cloak. And then in Quran 74, 1 through 5, it says, O thou who art shrouded in thy mantle, so he's covered in this blanket, rise and warn, thy Lord magnify, thy robes purify, and from iniquity flee. So, it, you know, in this type of Old English, it actually reads like something we, you know, may read in the Bible about people experiencing different visions from angels. So what is the purpose of Muhammad's vision? Why is he receiving these? You would think that the angel would at least explain to him what it is. So what is he being ordered to do? And what he's being ordered to do is he's supposed to make God's exhortation known, and he's supposed to make the divine presence known to the Arabs, specifically, initially. Okay. And he's supposed to warn them of a judgment day when everything that they do is going to be called into account. Okay, so what all is the context of that? And the Quran tells us in the 109th surah. When the earth shall quake with a predestined quaking, when the earth shall bring forth her burdens, and men shall ask what ails her, upon that day shall she tell her news, with which thy Lord has inspired her. Upon that day shall men come out in scattered groups to be shown what they have done. Then he who has done one atom's weight of good shall see it, and he who has done one atom's weight of evil shall see it. So the basis of what he's supposed to do as the prophet is give the message of God to the Arabs, warn them of an impending judgment. Okay. So now he's received his first vision, and we have the beginnings of Islam because he is now gaining his first converts, which of course are going to be the his family and close friends. Okay. So where do we get all these terms, Islam, Muslim? Those words sound the same, and they sound the same for a reason. They're both Arabic words. Islam just means submission. And in this context, it means submission to God. And I put Allah in parentheses there because from here on out, I'm going to be referring to Allah as Allah. In books like this one, they translate, and it's not that it's an incorrect translation, they translate Allah as God because that's what the Arabic word translates to. However, I don't feel comfortable using those words interchangeably because God, capital G, is a name that we have for the one true God. And Allah is not the one true God. He is a distortion of our one true God. So if you're following along, I will be differentiating between Allah, the Muslim God, little g, and our God, capital G. So that way there's no confusion about who it is that I'm specifically referencing. So then, what is a Muslim? A Muslim is just one who submits. And so it's very difficult to get direct translations for some Arabic words. These two, it's pretty straightforward. In the sense that if a Muslim is, again, in this context, one who submits to Allah, or again, if we translate that Arabic word to God, are we congregationally not a group of people who submit to God? We would define ourselves as such. So then would we be Muslims? No, right? So that's where translations are lost, but that's where the name of this religion comes from. There's a couple other words that you may see associated with Islam and Muslim. M-O-S-L-E-M is just another spelling for Muslim. Okay. So how many of you have seen Arabic writing before? It's not Greek letters, right? So it's similar to when you see a Chinese word that's written out in our alphabet, we're just using letters that phonetically sound like the thing that the Chinese person is saying. And that usually means, and there has been several times, where those spellings change. So I've been teaching about the Chinese Civil War in some of my classes, and I look at a name and I go, that's not the name of the person that I learned about when I was in school. It's the same person, it's just that they changed the spelling because it was more closely related to how it sounded. So for somebody's ear, it sounded more like Muslim, and so that's how they spelled it. Okay, we spell it like Muslim. You'll also see multiple spellings of Quran. I've actually changed my spelling because in the first lesson I spelled it K-O-R-A-N, but the more common spelling is Q-U apostrophe R-A-N. So that's what I've gone to because I think it's a little bit more accurate. Okay, Mohammedanism is very difficult to say. It's way easier to say Islam, so we'll just say that. But you may see in some, especially like ancient documentation of Islam, they may refer to it as this. There's also a bunch of different spellings of the prophet's name, Muhammad. And that's one of the ways that you can spell it. I am spelling it M-U-H-A-M-M-E-D. It is not an incorrect spelling, but it depends on who you ask. doesn't it? So there could be an American Muslim who comes in and is like, oh, you're misspelling the prophet's name. Well, no, I'm not. Muhammad's early message, and this is from W. Montgomery Watt, who is quoted in this book, Concise History of the Middle East. Here is what his message is to the Arabs. Allah is good and all-powerful. Allah will call all men and women back to himself for judgment. People should thank Allah through worship. Allah expects people to share their wealth. And Muhammad is the prophet of Allah to his people, the Jews. Nope. To his people, the Arabs. And you can once again sort of see that Muhammad may have enough surface knowledge of Judaism to know that the Jews refer to themselves as God's people, and now he's kind of twisting that. And it could be intentional, or it could just be Muhammad's ignorance of the topic. Now he's referring to himself as the prophet to God's people, Allah's people, the Arabs, which we would go, wait, that's not right. That's the first of many things, you know, in Islam that you'll go, wait, that doesn't seem right. And just remember, the Allah that he's referring to, he believes is the same God that we have recorded in our new Old and New Testaments. Okay? So already we've had some issue. This is the earliest message that he's giving to the first converts of Islam, is this stuff. And we go, that's interesting. That's a strange change of language. Yeah.
I'm curious, on Muhammadanism, would they appreciate being called that? Because my understanding is they don't like that. Or is that just what we, some who see it as Muhammadanism, call that?
I would say they wouldn't like that because they view Islam as the one true religion of the one true God and not just some guy's religion. We view it as some guy's distortion of and basically lying about getting these transcripts.
So they're not going to call themselves, they're not going to call the religion Muhammadanism.
Uh-uh. Yeah. Mr. Pierce?
It's interesting about the timing of this. When I was studying some of the translations of the Bible, I remember that the Latin Vulgate was translated around 392, right at the end of the 4th century, and the guy
Seventh, yep.
But he's locked himself in a cage. It's just interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And that piece of information is going to be vitally important when we start talking about what Muslims believe in accordance to with the New Testament. Because they believe the New Testament to be the Word of God, but that over time, translations of it have been so corrupted that Christians now believe that Jesus is the Messiah instead of just the prophet of Allah. But going back to that exact issue, that's going to be paramount in a Christian's argument against Muslims for that exact fact, that they say that it's been corrupted, and you go, when would it have been corrupted? Because our New Testament is based on manuscripts that we have that go back much farther than what you have from the Quran. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that was the case. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead, Mrs. Ortel. Sorry, I need to go by name so people know who I'm calling on. I haven't found that yet. That's not to say that there may not be some sort of belief. I don't, because that would be elevating. They are very careful about how high they elevate people and even prophets, because there's Allah and he is the only one and he is the only powerful God. And so there's nothing that they can do to get them anywhere on the same plane as Allah. And that is different, and that's different than what the Mormons believe, because they actually do believe that when they get to heaven, depending on, I think, how they're rewarded, that they'll essentially be what God is to our world, to another world. And that God was once basically he was rewarded by, it's heretical to
so
an absolute T, but, correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Maybe you said it, but I know you said his uncle, Abu Talib, influenced him, but what would he have considered himself before he started his...
Abu Talib?
No.
Or what would...
Oh,
you know, I'm sure he practiced probably the polytheistic Meccan religion in some way. I don't know how devout he was, but the Meccans and the pilgrims that went to Mecca to practice this religion, it wasn't really a heartfelt thing. It was just something that they had always done. It was based on tradition. It was ancestor worship. There's animism, spirituality, or spiritism. That was characteristic of that religion. And so if he was sort of half-heartedly practicing it, he would have been just like most of the other people of that time.
So since it was polytheistic, it's probably hard to say what he was because it could be any combination of...
The safest bet, historically speaking, is that he was whatever term we have for this Meccan religion, because it was the most pervasive in the Middle East at the time. No. And I don't know. In this book, they don't actually specifically name what that religion was. They just call it an ancient Middle Eastern religion, polytheistic religion. And they give the characteristics of it, but they don't actually give it a name. I'll answer by continuing onto this slide. So if you look at, well, the first bullet point, so that actually works out really well. The first bullet point there is... his compromise with Meccan pagans. And based on this compromise, we know that he had a knowledge of the religion that was more than just like a familiarity with it. He actually knew some of the gods and some of the practice of the religion, and which once again leads me to believe that that was what he was himself probably converted from. But this slide is... I can't fit all the information that I'm going to expound on for each of these bullet points, but this is a really, really good point in the evolution of Islam to talk about Muhammad's evolving revelations and how they just seem to come at the most convenient times. So that first point that I was referring to, initially, when he starts getting converts and this religion begins to gain traction in Mecca, the Meccan leaders don't like it because they're worried that if he gets enough converts, that he will take away the pilgrimage to Mecca and all the money that's being made by the city. And so there's a lot of opposition against Muhammad, and this is where his uncle Abu Talib comes in. They can't just go after him and kill him because of the influence of Abu Talib. They're, you know, he's offering protection to Muhammad and his teachings. Now, Abu Talib does not actually ever become a convert to Islam, and we'll talk about that next. But when he's faced with this opposition from the Meccans, what we find is that in some accounts, historical accounts, he concedes to the Meccan leaders that the three pagan goddesses, Al-Lat, Al-Uzza, and Al-Manat, were sacred swans, in quotation marks here that I'm quoting, worthy of veneration. And so the prophet of Allah, whose whole message, summarized by Watt, was that God is good and all-powerful, and that there's only one true God, and it's the whole thing that the Muslims recite, early accounts depict him willing to compromise on the entire basis of the religion, simply so more people will accept his teachings. Now, I do have to make sure that you understand these are just a few accounts, and if you talk to a Muslim about this, they'll vehemently deny that this ever took place. But it's interesting that this book points it out, because it certainly does fall in line with what we see happening with these other bullet points. His uncle, Abu Talib, and this is from a lecture by Dr. James White, and Pastor, I don't know if you know who that is. Okay, and I just need to make sure that you know I put a caveat here. If I quote somebody, like I'm not saying that Dr. James White professes to be a Christian, and he's done a lot of debates. He has a very good historical knowledge of the canon of Scripture, and he has done tons of research into Islam, and he's a very, very good resource for me as I go through this. But I can't stand up here and openly say I don't know enough about him to say everything that he teaches scripturally is good. But in this lecture that he gives, talking about the death of Abu Talib, what he says is that imams in Islam get one intercession, and Muhammad, and there's passages in the Quran that talk about this, he saved his one intercession, he is saving it, if you're a Muslim, for the last judgment so that he can intercede for people who have committed sins against Allah, except for the two unforgivable sins in Islam that we'll talk about later. So Muhammad is saving his one intercession with Allah because he was an imam for that time. Except Muhammad gets an extra intercession. And he's the only one that gets it because his uncle never says the Muslim recitation that leads to conversion. He's on his deathbed and they're trying to get him to say it and he never does. And so he dies an unbeliever, which means he goes to hell. And Muhammad gets an extra intercession with Allah that allows Abu Talib to be in the best possible version of hell, according to Muslim teaching. So once again, how convenient that Muhammad receives Quranic revelation that says that he gets an extra intercession, even though he didn't get one before. So now he gets to intercede on the behalf of his uncle who raised him, which I'm sure he was very close to, but that seems, once again, it's just a very convenient timing, more convenient timing. So now there's caravan raids after the Hijra and the Muslims move to Medina. Muhammad receives revelations in the Quran that you can attack caravans. And all of a sudden, this religion of peace is now saying, yep, it's okay to do violence against people as long as you do it in the name of Allah and it's helping the cause and so forth. Which, and that's a very, you know, I'm making it as basic as possible, but super convenient, right? And now, what about marriage? So Muslim teaching states that a Muslim man can have up to four wives, but not more. And he can only have up to four wives if he treats them all equally. What about Muhammad? Oh, he can have 12. What? So why does he get 12? And to make sure the people know that this wasn't just Muhammad making an exception for himself, he gets Quranic revelation about it. What about funeral decorum? No wailing at funerals, says Muhammad. You cannot wail at funerals. There can be no outward, you know, loud expression of grief until his son dies. And then you can do it. What about the treatment of Jews and Christians? That's supposed to read "and Christians." People that Muhammad refers to in the Quran as people of the book. How are you supposed to treat them? Initially, you're supposed to treat them with respect. And the first part, the first parts of the Quran that teach on Jews and Christians, they are considered believers even. And that, if a Christian, a Christian is well-intentioned and is worshiping Allah by practicing their religion. What happens after Muhammad and his followers move to Medina and the Christians and the Jews reject him as a prophet of Christianity? Well, now you can kill him. And the entire tone and tenor of how you're supposed to treat the people of the book changes. Why? Because of the political circumstances that Muhammad finds himself in. And these are just the ones that I've listed. These are not even all of the revelations that Muhammad receives that make you go, what? Well, how does that work? Because there's plenty of times in marriages, and Pastor, I'll go ahead and let you.
So is what you're referring to sounds like abrogation? Have you read about that? Where the latest revelation is the one you believe, and it abrogates the others.
Yeah, and I think what Muhammad tried to do is make sure that he wasn't contradicting himself, and so he would basically just get a more specific revelation, maybe, about something that would not necessarily change or abrogate the previous one, but would just be more specific about it.
But then how can you be more specific about not killing Christians and Jews and men who can kill them?
That would be...
That's specificity.
Yeah, and that's one of the many... That I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that that's one of the teachings in the Quran that the Muslims say, well, that's an unclear teaching, and that they kind of... that involves a lot of study and thought, and we have to figure out what exactly he was saying there. But on the topic of marriage, Muhammad ends up marrying the wife of his adopted son. And it was after his adopted son divorced his wife. And there was a lot of criticism surrounding that marriage. Lo and behold, there's a revelation about it. And people were said, you can't basically the, and I'll find the specific passages in the Quran that reveal these truths. But once again, if you look at it from a historical context and you see when he's receiving these revelations, you go, he's definitely manipulating sort of what he thinks are his revelations to he's experiencing. I think this is a good time, and it's a good point time to wrap up too. But this is a good point in the series to say I don't know personally what happened or what the instances were surrounding his revelations, especially his initial revelation, because as I said before, the only account of that revelation is the account that Muhammad gives. Did he actually have a revelation? Now, as Christians, we can say it wasn't the angel Gabriel, and it certainly wasn't, someone from God, because they weren't going to give him a revelation that is so contradictory to our scriptures. So, did he actually get a revelation, and it was a demonic revelation? Did he just make the whole thing up? Was he, mentally unstable? It's impossible for us to know. He could have been, in fact, a very well-intentioned person that just came up with a story and thought, you know what, the religion of my city is not that good, and the religion of these people seems like it's working out pretty well for them. And so I'm going to just take some pieces of this, I'm going to cast myself as a prophet, and I'm going to see if I can help my city by structuring this new religion for everyone to follow. And it might have started innocently enough, or it could have started with a lot more maybe insidious types of motives. Maybe he was just in it for himself. Maybe he was just a selfish guy. Maybe he was deceived. It's very, very difficult for us to know. And so we can't say emphatically one way or the other, and it's really just up to your personal conjecture based on the information that I give you as to how you might interpret that. Do you have a question?
You kind of answered my question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of information on him. Did Muhammad, was there enough information on his relations with others or anything like that that would have caused him to think, to write something like this? And was he the only writer of the Quran?
Yes, he was.
Okay. So
yep.
No one else influenced that?
No. All the information that we have about his early life is essentially what I've already gone over, and there might be some more. There's more specific accounts that you could read into about those years, but again, for the most part, it seems like he's just kind of living a pretty middle class basic way of life for that time period, and then he claims to receive this vision, and it just kind of, at least as I'm reading through it, it just kind of comes out of the blue, like why this guy? Why is he all of a sudden, you know, does he feel like he's a prophet of this new religion? Of course, there's got to be something that evolves in his life that's just not recorded. And he's not going to record that, because then that casts him in an unfavorable light. And it seems like he's not receiving a revelation. It just seems like, well, I had this internal struggle and doubting about stuff, and then I came up with this story. Yes, Mr. Rochelle. I haven't seen anything that specific. I do know that there are, and I want to make sure that I quote these. Okay, so if you go down to the last subpoint there, the Sunnah and Hadith, those were written by other people about Muhammad and his teachings. They're not Quranic. So I'm wondering if people would have correctly stated that about the Sunnah and the Hadith. And those are religious texts. They teach about Islam and how to live and the different ways of life of Muhammad. The Quran specifically, I don't know if he physically wrote it down. I haven't seen anything that addresses that, but it could be quite possible that he would have had them written by scribes. Tradition states that he was illiterate, so that when he receives this initial vision from the angel Gabriel, and the angel is commanding him to read, he's repeatedly telling the angel, I can't read. You know, you're telling me to read this, that these words that you've put in front of me, and I can't read. And so Muslims do believe that he was illiterate at the time, which would then raise suspicion as to whether or not he was the actual author or he was just having someone transcribe it for him. So he may have learned to write or not. It was a miracle. Yeah, he had a vision. Yeah, that's how we learned to write. Okay, we will stop there and.